Schillheimer.
May it please the court, Ed Schillheimer and Daniel Webb, on behalf of the appellants, and for the because this is a termination of parental rights case, in order to protect the identity of the child, I'm going to refer to the to my clients. The father is John, and the paternal grandfather is Don, and the child is a pseudonym of just simply D. And it's my privilege to be here today to give voice to John, the father, who is a young man who lives in Tennessee. He's basically always lived in Tennessee and now finds himself some thousand miles away in a Texas courtroom challenging a decision of the trial court to forever terminate his parental rights to his young son. Certainly those parental rights have a constitutional importance, whether he's a member from Tennessee or Texas. Our U.S. Supreme Court has talked about how fundamental and precious those parental rights are. I know this court hears a lot of termination of parental rights cases. I've read a lot of the termination of parental rights cases, and there's a lot of them. And this case is different, I think, Your Honors, because this case doesn't involve a parent who's done drugs. It doesn't involve a parent who's been incarcerated, nor a parent who's physically or sexually abused his child, nor allowed his child to live in a deplorable living conditions. At least as far as the father, it doesn't involve mental illness. And it also doesn't involve the Department of Protective and Regulatory Services recommending termination of parental rights. In this case, we have a father who the sister agency to the department in Tennessee did a home study and recommended and filed a report with the court that he is an appropriate parent, an appropriate home for this child in Tennessee. And the department at trial recommended placement of the child and return of the child to the father. Although there are important constitutional issues that are raised in our brief, I don't think it's necessary for the court to reach those because it should clearly be decided, I think, on the fact that the trial court does not have grounds. Neither of the grounds found by the trial court are appropriate under the law or facts in this case. Those grounds are first, subsection H, which is a requirement that a parent knowingly, with knowledge of pregnancy, fail to support a child during pregnancy and on through birth and fail to provide medical care. The problem with that, Your Honor, and we objected to this through the introduction of evidence at trial and continue to object to it, is that we have here an alleged father. There was, and that's important under the family code because parent in Title V is defined in Section 101.024. And it does not include an alleged father. A parent, here we have a person who was never married to the mother. They had a brief relationship up in Tennessee. They had a pregnancy test, two pregnancy tests at a pregnancy clinic before breaking up, both of which were negative. And they broke up, and the mother ended up in Texas, giving birth in Texas, no evidence that she didn't have appropriate medical care. John did not think he was the father of this child. He did not. He requested from day one, from the first contacts with the department, he continually requested DNA testing. It took a while, for whatever reason, it took a while, unfortunately, for that DNA testing to occur. And it was not until December when the DNA test results got back and showed that he was a father that he admitted paternity in an admission of paternity that was filed in his original answer in January of this year. Under those facts, an alleged father does not have a duty to support a child until either a court determination or a clear admission of paternity. That's the Jimenez versus Little case, Your Honors, and that's been cited by several appellate courts. We also cite the court two cases, and I'm not sure I can pronounce either one properly, Dieto versus the department, and also the Propylac or Procupic versus Offenhauser case. Both of those cases stand for the proposition that you can't use a ground for termination of a ground that requires a duty of support for an alleged father. And all of the evidence related to John in this case with regard to paternity were during periods when he was only an alleged father. We believe that should be easily decided by the court. The only other ground found by the trial court, and somewhat incredibly, is subsection O, failure to provide or failure to follow a court order or comply with the court order. That is a problem in this case, one, because we don't believe there's actually a predicate court order under the AAA case, or even under the evidence, there was no admission of any court order, and the only court order that was entered was actually entered before John was even served or a party to the case. But even assuming that there was a predicate court order, the father in this case did everything by the conclusion of trial. And just so you understood the facts, the service plan that John agreed to, it was filed in November 30th, I believe, of 07, required him to obtain and maintain appropriate housing, which he did, required him to successfully complete a home study of his home in the state of Tennessee, required him to complete a drug and alcohol assessment and follow any recommendations, which he did, complete a psychological evaluation, complete parenting classes, obtained and maintained financial stability, and come to Tennessee regularly, a 15-hour drive each way to visit with his child and to obtain appropriate conduct and parenting, demonstrate appropriate parenting skills during his visitations. He did all of those things. The one thing that remained undone at the start of trial, which was, and I think these dates are important, on February 29th, there was a psychological report filed which recommended that he have individual counseling, primarily to deal with the stress of litigation and to having his child in CPS care. That was February 29th. On March 12th, he was at a permanency hearing and visiting his child, 3 days away from his job, all the time trying to maintain employment. Between March 12th and April 2nd, when trial started, 3 weeks, John lost both of his paternal grandparents in the state of Tennessee. They died 5 days apart. And he had not done his individual counseling at that time. The judge called a recess during the middle of his testimony and ordered John to go to counseling, to have his counselor talk to the department, and to file a report before trial resumed on April 25th. John did exactly that. He successfully completed undergoing intensive counseling, multiple sessions, and successfully completed counseling and had his counselor file a report to that effect by the time trial resumed on April 25th and before the judge made a ruling in this case. There was, at the end of the case, it's clear, Your Honor, the only way you can sustain that is if you find that a party somewhere along the line didn't do something, even though he completed it by the time a decision was to be made.
And he wasn't specifically ordered to undertake the individual psychological counseling until February 27th of 08, as opposed to November 30th of 07, correct?
Your Honor, I don't believe he was ever ordered to go, except, in fact, I think the only order that we have in the record is April 2nd, when Judge Walton tells him to go get counseling at that time.
When he's at the hearing. Okay.
Now, previously, before he even appeared in the case, there was an order saying, John, you ought to comply with the service plan. There was a service plan entered in November, and it said basically that you'll do a psychological evaluation and follow any recommendations. That service plan was also not admitted into evidence. It was filed, but it was not evidentially admitted into evidence. So we do not, there was no, and it certainly was not, to my knowledge, there's nothing in the record where the court ordered him, either verbally or in writing, once he appeared in the case, to follow the service plan. So that's one of the issues of whether we have a predicate order.
Okay.
The other issue of whether there's a predicate order, Your Honor, is that this child was removed from the hospital from the mother when he was 1 day old. It involved nothing that the father did, and there was no abuse or neglect to the father. There was only a risk from the mother. And whether conduct that requires from the mother can result in a predicate order in which you can terminate a father who wasn't involved in that conduct, I don't believe is appropriate under the circumstances. I would also go back to H, and I think it may go back to the other case, in that statutorily, the parent is defined. I think I did mention that, but parents are defined in the family code, and it doesn't include an alleged father. It does include a presumed father, and we think that's a big distinction here, Your Honor.
Well, I have let me just ask you about H and its application here. H requires the parent voluntarily, with the knowledge of the pregnancy, abandon the mother of the child. And is that not what we have here? I mean, did he not, after he learned the pregnancy, did he not ask her to leave?
No, I think that's absolutely not right, Your Honor. I think the evidence showed that she thought she might be pregnant. And they went together, they went to a pregnancy clinic and had a test run twice. That test showed that she was not pregnant. And based on that, they broke up. And actually, his grandmother, where they were living, had asked her to leave the house when she was not pregnant. The mother said she did not, in fact, learn that she was pregnant until 6 weeks later. That's in the affidavit in her statement to the mother.
Okay, so 6 weeks into the pregnancy,
the mother learned she was pregnant.
Mother learned. Okay, at what point did the father learn?
I think that's unclear. I think it's probably possibly 8 to 9 months into the pregnancy, because the mother never called the father. She did call the father's parent, Don, and tell him, but the record is clear that Don didn't talk to his son about that conversation for a couple of months. And that was when she was, I believe, in Ohio before she came to Texas, which is shortly before she came to Texas, which may have been a month or two before the child was born, is he learned of a possibility that she might be pregnant. By that time, she was already with another man. In fact, there was some talk about him being the father of the child, and his testimony was clear that he did not know she was, did not believe that she was pregnant with his child. He mentioned that, and that there were never any positive pregnancy tests where they were together. I believe he testifies to that four separate times. And the only evidence contrary to that is in a standing hearing where the issue wasn't brought up, and it was from Don, who mentioned something about a positive pregnancy test, which neither parent confirmed, and John and actually both of them deny in the mother's written statements and in John's verbal testimony.
Would you agree, Mr. Seelheimer, that if there were evidence to support those first few elements of voluntarily with knowledge of the pregnancy abandon, that the test, at least with regard to the first prong of H, is whether the father, in this case, failed to provide support for the mother's medical expenses, not support, child support, as the little case or the Jimenez case talks about. And that even in the second prong, it's not so much a child support issue as perhaps it is just remaining apart from the child. I mean, would you agree with that construction of this provision, that it doesn't necessarily hinge on whether the parent provides child support, but it...
Your Honor, I believe it does hinge on whether there is a duty, on whether as a alleged father has a duty at that point in time before paternity has been established, whether it's to support the mother during pregnancy of the child. And if there is no duty, you know, I would not complain about the judge going back and finding a retroactive duty to provide support. But in this case, I think it is important that there was actually no evidence that appropriate medical care wasn't actually provided to the mother, that she didn't actually get good, appropriate medical care. And the public policy of saying that an alleged father can be terminated because somebody else, for whatever reason, provides appropriate maternity care for the mother of what turns out to be their child, I think would be awful public policy.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Michelle.
May it please the court, I do have the distinct privilege of representing Blake and Shannon Peoples here this morning.
I don't want to disrupt your argument that you may have planned to make, but could you address this question that I just asked Mr. Seelheimer, and that is regarding the knowledge of the pregnancy. What evidence is there that John knew Stacy was pregnant,
Your Honor,
before she actually gave birth?
Your Honor, we believe we have tremendous amount of evidence presented at the trial court below. I've detailed it, and I'm going to tell the court, but it's extensively in my statement of facts. I put it again under the H section, where I do more of a detail, and then I hit it up again very hard in the reply brief again.
Well, I'm looking at page 23 of your brief.
That's where it starts. Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. First of all, Stacy had been repeatedly complaining about being pregnant. John's father, Don, testified, and this is uncontradicted in the record, that there were two positives and two negatives. And also, you have to understand, you will see some contradictory cites in the record to supporting evidence, given that this John was somewhat all over the map in his testimony. He'll say one thing, and then he'll be contradicted on the next. And so he testified he basically kicked Stacy out of the house. That goes to the abandonment argument. When he got tired of her taking her to the hospital because she was always complaining.
But my question is, what evidence is there that he actually knew that she was pregnant with his child?
Well, that's a combination question. I don't know if you meant it that way. One is whether you're pregnant.
Well, I did mean it that way.
There's two issues. You're never going to know their person is pregnant with your child until the child is born. I mean, even if you're married, seriously, that's a big issue. And that goes to subsection H about knowledge. That's why the cases that we've gone through and we've distinguished, quite frankly, is because the code looks at pre-birth and post-birth. Nobody is going to know for sure that that's your child unless, some extreme, whatever examples you can come up with. But you're never going to know for sure. But the code imposes, and the cases we've cited, this court has held in RW, that the courts look before pre- and post-birth. So, Judge, that's why I wanted to hit on that issue. You're never going to know for sure before birth. You may have suspicions, strong likelihoods. Secondly,
well, I respect your opinion on that.
Okay.
I don't want to get into an argument on whether I would know whether my wife's child is my child. But okay, let's break it up like you suggested that would be best to do. What evidence is there that when did John know that Stacy was pregnant?
Well,
actually pregnant, not when she just said, "I think I'm pregnant."
Okay. Well, this is the testimony we have in the record.
Okay.
He did not physically see her, if that's the question. But Stacy called Don, the father, John's father, and repeatedly told, "I am pregnant. I have spotting. It's confirmed. I am pregnant." Don, the father, told John, "I am 100% convinced that you're the father." He said, "Stand up and do your duty."
And at what point in time?
This is while she was in Ohio. She went from Tennessee to Ohio to Texas. Stacy called repeatedly and spoke to Don. This is uncontroverted in the record. Don, the father, repeated. John wouldn't talk to her. So Don, you can't just bury your head in the sand. So, because at times John was living with the father and he was supporting him and working with his father's company. John's father, Don, repeatedly said, "Hey, Stacy's pregnant. I'm 100% sure not only is she pregnant, but you're the father." And also, Don, the father, is the one who testified that there were two pregnancy tests. Now, remember, no pregnancy tests were actually admitted into evidence. So all this evidence is based on just on testimony of actual pregnancy tests. So Stacy repeatedly called from Ohio to Tennessee saying, "I'm pregnant.
To
the father.
And the testimony in the record is that Don told John shortly after that.
Yes. You're the father.
Stacy called and
said, "Stand up to the and don't run away from this. Do your responsibility. Don't bury your head in the sand." She calls from Texas and says, "I'm pregnant." All of this is before pregnancy. Now, Judge, anybody can just say, "I'm just going to." Basically, he just says, "I'm not the father." That's his response. "I'm just not the father." Doesn't explain why. Now, I think. Now, these are two unmarried people, but they did live together. He agreed, and this is how the cross-examination went, and I think you have to prove this up. And because John's testimony was so contradictory and so self-serving, that the judge was free to judge this young man on the stand, and determine the credibility of this young man, and said, come on. You got this woman calling you repeatedly. She doesn't have any money. She's asking for money. She repeatedly asked for money. And John just responds, "I'm not it." That same line of action is carried forward when the child is born, Judge. That's why his credibility was seriously challenged at trial. The department calls him up, doesn't return the phone call. Who returns the phone call? The grandfather returns the phone call. Grandfather says, he says he has no interest in this child. Why? Because he just got married again.
Well, let's go to the second part of that question that I asked earlier. And at what point did he know that she was pregnant with his child and not somebody else's?
Well, I think if the court is going to come down and say, "When do you know somebody's pregnant with your child?" I think you're not going to get that a conclusive answer until the paternity test was taken. I don't know how else you would divine knowledge but for a DNA test. I think in these situations you have to look at...
Well, I think, you say it's impossible for somebody to know, and I think I understand what you're saying, but in the realm of, evidence, we don't have 100% certain of anything, but we do have...
Right.
Standards of proof, and there could be evidence in this case, for example, that Stacy did not have sex with anybody else other than John during the period of which, that would be relevant to her conceiving a child and so forth.
I think what we do have is they were together. They lived together for 3 months. She complained she was pregnant at that time, repeatedly asserted then went to Ohio, and when it was confirmed for sure that she started showing and having a baby, she repeatedly called back and said, "It's John's baby." Then comes down to Texas, and the only person who's alleged to be the father is John. No one else is alleged even to have been the father.
Nobody else stepped into the picture, and there's no evidence that she was having sex with anybody else other than John during
Correct.
The period.
There's no evidence to that effect. So then we go, that's the knowledge. And I think Judge, no disrespect to a happily married couple, which I put myself in that category, but when you have a younger couple who are not married and are living together, you're right, the 100% proof, but you can infer knowledge from events and acts, and knowledge can be inferred by the events that transpired. We have them living together. He admits, testifies on the stand, they had sex together. Don, the father, testifies there were two positive pregnancy tests. That's uncontradicted in the record. It's never been challenged that there were two positive pregnancy tests. Then we have uncontradicted testimony. John confirms that, yeah, she called from Ohio, said she's pregnant. John's the baby. Dad says to John, she's the child. She goes to Texas getting ready to have the baby. The only person she alleges who possibly could be an alleged father, the only person, is John. I don't know what other type of evidence, quite frankly, you can really get to prove knowledge, because we have to now go in John's head and prove his knowledge. So I think you prove it by circumstantial evidence, other than people telling you. And
the brief says he's 17. How old is she when she has the baby?
She was about 25 or 26. Mm-hmm. She was about...
And also you mentioned that the child was removed because of a mental illness, alleged, I guess, hers?
Correct.
Does the record go into that in any more detail? Is there any more testimony on that?
You know, there's really not much testimony on it. There's really just the intake form of DPS, and that's where they draw it from, is from what the DPS worker intook.
How soon after that does she sign an affidavit of relinquishment?
I think it is a couple weeks or a month or so after the action is instituted. She then files her affidavit.
And she hasn't challenged any of that?
No, she has not. DPS then calls up, and I draw this analogy about knowledge of John, as much as we can prove knowledge in someone's head.
Well, isn't it to your benefit, counsel, to take the position that knowledge that this is your child does not have to be proved by scientific DNA? I mean,
absolutely.
Okay,
well, absolutely.
That's kind
absolutely.
Of where I was going with
I'm
this.
I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that. I don't think.
Well, I just don't see anything in the statute that requires that the paternity be established just voluntarily with knowledge of the pregnancy, and so I'm trying to get a feel for where you think the bar is for proof of this element. Is it where counsel for the appellant says, or is it something less?
That's well, I think it's if you look at the two extremes, and I think we might be at somewhat of the extremes. His is you don't have a duty until paternity is established, when the child is 11 months old, that he's got no duty till I get a DNA test. I would say that's about as far over here as you can get, which I say that can't be the test. And we've cited you a number of cases on there that state that can't be the test, because you won't be able to establish paternity until after the child's born, and yet the test under the statute is one of the elements is knowledge of the pregnancy before the child's born. I mean, it's impossible. That's impossible to be the standard.
But how do you reconcile that position with the cases that hold that there's no legal obligation to support until paternity is established?
Those were a line of cases from about the 1990s, Judge, and I went through, including this court in RW. That line of cases have been completely distinguished and criticized and really limited to Section D endangerment cases. Not a single case has ever been applied to Section H, which part of its element is knowledge of the pregnancy. So how could you establish paternity? Those cases, I've cited a litany of cases. There's a lot more when I was responding to this argument. We cited the RW case, the Phillips case, the Stevenson case. We've cited a number of cases that say that's not the test. There is a duty. The courts have always been looking to duties before birth activities and after birth activities. So once again, I think that's a misleading. Not only is it, I don't think it's currently the correct state of law. To the extent it is still the law by those San Antonio Court of Appeals, even San Antonio came back and limited its own opinion and said it only applies in Section D cases on the endangerment. If you're going to look about the endangerment, which is somewhat entailed, you've got a child out there. Do I have the duty to come in and, you know, remove the child from a dangerous environment? The court in that situation said, we're not going to impose that affirmative obligation for you to go in and remove a child from a dangerous situation unless you know it's your child. So I think if you want to look for a logical distinction between those subsections, that makes sense on those applications between D and E. But none of them have been, not a single case has ever been applied to H. And I think the record's undisputed that the department called John, said, hey, to say under O real quickly, to say that the child wasn't removed because of neglect, I think is disingenuous because the state was left with nothing to do but remove the child because the father wouldn't step up. They called. They wanted to place the child with the alleged father. He said, nope, I ain't going to do it. Dad said he's in another relationship, not interested, refused to take any type of paternity test, once again, highly contradicted down at trial about why he could take a paternity test. The department said, yeah, we take private paternity tests. You can FedEx it, and we'll have it the next time. Instead, it took 11 months. I think based on this record, the best interest standards, we went through all of that. Clearly, this child is thriving in his current environment. One reason why they don't like to remove children, to bounce the children around. That's why they asked the alleged father to come down here and step up to the plate now, because we're going to take this child and put him in a home for adoption. And now that's what they've done. This child thinks the Peoples are his parents. They love this child. They have a home, a happy home. They're raising him, they've bonded. This child has suffered enough. It has a happy home environment. John has been unstable. He's gone from home to living on an apartment to his grandmother's house to his cousins with his cousin to now back to his father. We've seen his MySpace book page, which is something to behold. The things about that nature.
Is that in the record?
It is testified to in the record, and we cited it in the reply brief. The web page, I don't believe, was actually admitted into evidence. But based on that, I think the best interest standards, I went through each of the nine elements. I think all of them highly favor the stability, and this child will have a stable life with the loving parents that this child has. We ask the court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you.
Mr. Seelheimer.
Your Honor, Mr. Michelle is wrong. And I believe the pronunciation is Prokopic, Offenheiser case, which follows the DeJato case and Jimenez case. In that case, they did consider, and it was at issue, whether the abandonment with knowledge of pregnancy was one of the grounds for termination that the court said you cannot do under the DeJato case, under the Jimenez case. And that's cited in my brief. And I think the distinction, Your Honor, the distinction made by the San Antonio Court of Appeals has to do with the duty that's involved between when you have an alleged father who has no duty until paternity is established or he admits paternity or you have a court order. That's when the duty is established. Now, a person who... and that's why a parent who has no duty and no rights to control a child's surroundings can't be terminated under the grounds for controlling the surroundings or placing the person with someone else who harms the child. But a person does have a duty by their own conduct not to endanger a child, whether he's a parent or not. And that's the distinction that's been made from the DeJato case, that if you engage in conduct, whether you're an alleged parent or a presumed parent or a married parent or a court whose parent's been determinative, then if you engage in conduct that actually harms your child, then your parental rights can be terminated. And, Your Honor, in this case, I think the statute itself, the definition of parent, 101.024, a parent means the mother, a man presumed to be the father, a man legally determined to be the father, a man who has been adjudicated by a court of competent jurisdiction, a man who has acknowledged paternity under applicable law, or an adoptive mother or father. It does not include an alleged father who denies paternity.
Okay, is that a disjunctive? I hadn't looked at that statute recently. Is that
or? Yes, sir. It's
well,
or.
Then is it not possible in this, or could this an argument? Could not an argument be made in this case that John was presumed to be the father?
No, Your Honor. A presumed father is defined in the code. A presumed father would be the married, the person who was married, who attempted to have married
okay.
the mother, or they had been actually married or had attempted to marry
but
the
it
mother.
Wouldn't apply to a couple living together for a period of time and under circumstances such that it happens. Yeah.
Having had relationships. And there was evidence that there was another man in her VOV immediately after she left John. But what the problem is in this case, and it gets to the constitutional issues and the best interest issues, is when you take a square peg and try to fit it in a round hole to get the result that apparently the trial court wanted in this case of termination and try to make these facts fit, it doesn't work. And if you try to make it work, the problem is you can't do it and still we remain within the Constitution requirements of strict scrutiny, of construing these statutes in favor of the parent, which you're required to do. There is no compelling interest, Your Honors, to terminate a fit parent who's ready, willing, and able to provide a good place for his child. There is nothing in the conduct that either the two items that he did that is causally linked to any harm to his child, and that is a requirement, I believe, under the best interest test as set forth in my brief, as well as a requirement for the statute to be constitutional. The state has no compelling state interest in terminating a fit parent. I believe that's U.S. constitutional law, and you can't massage and manipulate or contort the facts in this case and get to a constitutional conclusion for a young man who has never done anything to harm his child and is ready, willing, and able to provide for his child. In fact, on March 12th, he should have been given custody of his child at the permanency hearing, but was not even allowed to call testimony at that time when he was ready, willing, and able to provide for his child. I think this case should be, because there's no custody at issue, should be reversed and remanded.
And how old is the child?
Reversed and rendered.
How old is the child today? How old is the child? I'm sure it's somewhere in the brief.
January 10th, 2007 was his birth date. I'm going from memory, so about 18 months. And John has been seeking custody since December 5th when the paternity test came back.
Right. Well, another tough case. Thank you both for appearing here.